O God, great mystery, who loves us, we are here in your presence, and we pray that your presence will be known to us now and later. In Jesus' name, amen. I've called this session Spirituality 101, and I'm Brad Holt, just for the tape. The purpose of the session is to get acquainted with the term spirituality and some of the related terms and what it might mean within the context of Christianity, particularly, to speak about spirituality. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you to be involved in this discussion. I'm not just going to lecture. And I would like to begin by asking you to talk to someone else. Have a discussion partner or two. And I'd like you to think about these words I put up on the board here: spirituality, faith, theology, spirit, ethics, religion. And consider what spirituality might mean to you as you consider these and perhaps other related words that you'd like to bring into the conversation. It's not easy to define spirituality, and many people use it in different senses. So always when you hear the word, try to pin down the person if you can as to what they mean by it, because many people mean different things by it. Let me move us along a little bit here by making two other kinds of distinctions about this term. One is that one can speak not only of spirituality, but of a spirituality. That is to say, one can use this term in the plural, spiritualities. When one speaks in that way, one is recognizing that there are varieties of ways in which people live their spirituality. And so, you can distinguish different types or styles of spirituality and name each one a spirituality and put it alongside the others. Now, when you do that, there are basically, there are a number of distinctions to be made. One is between religious spiritualities and non-religious spiritualities. Religious spiritualities would include Christian spiritualities, Jewish spiritualities, Islamic spiritualities, and so on, of all the religions of the world. Non-religious spiritualities would be those that arose outside a particular religious tradition, like New Age spirituality or 12-step spirituality. And these two are very important cultural influences in America at the present time. And so a good deal of what we hear about spirituality has been influenced, I believe, by one of those two. I have a book up here called Spirituality and the Secular Quest. Now, this is heavy academic stuff, but it's part of a series called World Spirituality, an Encyclopedic History of the Religious Quest. And we have the word religious in the subtitle, you'll notice. And there are volumes in this series on all the world religions, 3 volumes on Christianity, by the way. But this one is about spirituality outside of religion, and it does talk about New Age, feminist outside of any religion, and 12-step spiritualities, among others, as part of an attempt since the Enlightenment in particular for people to find spirituality outside of religion. And if any of you have had contact with the 12-step movement, you know that that is one place where there's a sharp distinction we're saying goodbye to the bus, to the fast boat. They make a sharp distinction between spirituality and religion. And they do so because alcoholics in particular, and perhaps other people who profit from 12-step groups, have a very negative reaction to religion, to God, to the church. And to speak about spirituality is a way to begin to speak about God, which doesn't have all the implications which the person brings to the program. And some people, not all by any means, but some people have gone into AA or another 12-step group hating anything to do with God and have come out eventually as very serious church members or synagogue members, having been had their whole concept of God and the church transformed. But at least officially, AA is not religious, it is not Christian, and it's an attempt to be a kind of generic spirituality which anyone of any background or any belief can use. Now notice that 12 steps are a recovery program, and a church is not simply a recovery program, so there's a little bit apples and oranges here. They aren't quite the same thing. And so as we who sit in this room answer the question, what is spirituality, we have a couple of things going. Many of us will be asking the question within the Christian tradition. Given that I am a Christian, what does spirituality mean for me? But others of us may wish to answer the question in a more broad sense in our culture. How do people use spirituality when they find the word in all these places over here, in Time magazine or Life or in the newspaper or the Lutheran magazine or books on New Age or self-help, Matthew Fox in New Age music or whatever. These are all places where people have heard the term spirituality, and of course it will be used in different ways by the different media. And so that's why some Christians, and particularly Christian theologians, are quite hostile to the term spirituality. They think that Christians shouldn't have anything to do with spirituality. They think that spirituality is a contradiction of the gospel of Jesus Christ because they see it as another attempt to justify ourselves before God apart from Jesus Christ. You may know that Karl Barth, in the middle of our century, said Christianity is not a religion, and the gospel is not a religion. Well, these theologians are saying that the gospel is not a spirituality. Now, obviously, I'm not of that persuasion, because I do use the term Christian spirituality together. And of course, I'm not alone in doing that, but I want you to be aware of the fact that the books about spirituality that you find at your local bookstore have influenced many Christians to say, we're not going to use this term. I think it is appropriate for us to use it for a couple of reasons. One is that Christians can use this term as a means of reaching out to people who are offended by the church and by what they think God is and what they think the Bible is without really knowing it very well. It's a way to speak to people in our culture, to give them an alternative to the secular quest. To say, maybe there's more to this Christian gospel than you thought. The other reason that I think that it's appropriate to use the term spirituality is that it came out of the church in the first place. It was Roman Catholics who first started using the term spirituality. And then later on came the more non-Christian sources of the term. Protestants have been slow to adopt the term. And I've indicated to you some of the reasons for that. Perhaps another reason is that they didn't want to copy the Catholics. Sometimes there's a thought, you know, we want to be different. We don't want to do the same thing as they do. But now, in the 1990s, both Protestants and Catholics are speaking about spirituality. At Luther Seminary, they came close to using the term spirituality, but the opposition was so great, they came to have settled finally on the term discipleship for a new emphasis for seminary students who were not getting much experiential attention, formation, as the Catholics call it, spiritual formation. They were not getting much of that. They're getting a lot of intellectual stuff, as I did when I was in seminary. But not much about the experience of living with God or walking with God. And attempting to set up something like that built into the seminary education program, they decided that they weren't going to use the term spirituality, they were going to use the term discipleship. So a case can be made for both of them. Now I'd like to say a few words about what I think a responsible Christian spirituality means or what it involves. And then I'd like to hear from you how you respond to that idea and whether you find it useful or you'd like to make amendments to it or so on. This vision of spirituality comes through in my book, Thirsty for God, A Brief History of Christian Spirituality, which I wrote a few years ago. In which the bookstore asks me to pass around to you. I will do that. They would like you to come and buy a copy, and of course I'd be happy about it too. And if you do, I'd be happy to sign it and write Holden Village, August 1997. It'll be kind of a souvenir, I suppose. Much of what I'll be teaching during the coming week relates to things, certain aspects of the book. Some of it goes beyond what's in the book. Here I have tried to describe spirituality in terms of four relationships. What is spirituality? Now, I haven't said here specifically Christian spirituality, but I have Christian spirituality in my mind, as you'll see. I say spirituality is how we relate to God, ourselves, other people, and the creation. By saying that, I'm attempting to include the insights that each of you have mentioned, namely that to have a spirituality, you have to believe there's more to reality than what you can see and touch. So any spirituality is in opposition to philosophical materialism, that all that exists is atoms and forces. It's a statement that there is a mystery to the universe. And that mystery, of course, has been described in different ways by different religions over the centuries and in different cultures. What is the shape of that mystery that is outside what we can see and touch? One answer, of course, is that there are many different powers, and each sort of specializing in one aspect. Another answer is that there is a sort of system or principle by which all things work together. Another answer, and the one that we're most familiar with, is that there is a more or less personal God, a creator, who is distinct from what we can see and touch, and yet related very closely to it. So among the world religions, you have non-theist or no-god religions like Buddhism. You have polytheist or many-god religions like Hinduism. And you have monotheistic or one-god religions like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Those three are very similar to each other in this way. All right, now if you're a Christian, this God is going to be very important, and of course that is for Christians a triune God who came incarnate among us in Jesus and who continues to dwell within us as Holy Spirit. I like the way some of you, I overheard you talking about the term spirituality in terms of spirit. If we as individuals and we together as a community of faith are weak, perhaps it is because we're not paying enough attention to that third person of the Trinity, who is the power of God within us and among us. I think that the tradition has focused a lot of attention on our relation to God and our relation to other people. And this suggests that both theology and ethics are important relatives of spirituality. Some of my criticism and others' criticism of secular spirituality is that it seems to be a spirituality without ethics. People would like to be free of guilt. They hate guilt today. And one of the ways of getting rid of guilt is to deny it. To do that, you remove all responsibility from yourself. The Christian spirituality would insist that there is an ethic, there is a responsibility and accountability for how we live our lives. In terms of other people, a special aspect of that relationship for Christians is the Christian community. In America, we are very individualist as we compare ourselves with other cultures. Yet we long for community, but our assumptions and our media and our habits all suggest that we are all by ourselves, and we decide all by ourselves about the major decisions of life. Christian spirituality, if it's healthy, will have a balance between the community and the individual. The culture pushes us toward just me and God, or just me. This is the kind of spirituality I was talking with at supper the other night with some people, and we were saying that for some people in the 1990s, they've gotten their BMW, they've gotten their three-car garage and the big house, they've got their golf membership, and they've got this and that and the other thing, but they still feel incomplete, and so they say, now I've got to add to all this. I'm going to go out as a consumer and find a spirituality and add that to my affluence. That's one kind of approach to spirituality today. What I'm saying is that authentic Christian spirituality must be rooted in the community. And especially for Lutherans and Catholics, that means, among other things, the sacraments. It means baptism and Eucharist are right at the middle of my personal spirituality, so that there's a balance between what I do within the Christian community and what I do by myself. Now, these other two relationships, to ourselves and to creation, have been ambivalent within the Christian tradition. We don't have such clear statements about them. sometimes we have misleading statements about them in the tradition. I'm afraid at this point I'm taking on two theological mentors who are much greater than I, and yet I must disagree with them. I'm speaking of Augustine and Luther. They seem to say that if you love yourself, you will not love God or your neighbor. But I call on my greater theological mentor, Jesus of Nazareth, who said, love your neighbor as you love yourself. He could have said, love your neighbor and hate yourself. But he said, love your neighbor as you love yourself. He assumed that you would love yourself. And he seemed to approve of that. And so we're called now to make a distinction between selfishness or egoism on the one hand and loving oneself on the other hand. That's a distinction that was never made to me as I grew up in the church, and it's an important distinction for me today. Loving myself is not trying to accumulate manna and having the biggest pile. Loving myself is nurture, is compassion. If I would help another person, or if I would have sympathy for another person, or if I would forgive another person for something, I should do the same for myself. But I tend to be much harder on myself than I am on other people. And I can even catch myself saying, well, God, you might forgive that, but I don't. I'm like Jonah, who says of God, you're an old softy. There you go again, forgiving the Ninevites. I would never forgive them. Learning God's compassion for me is part of my learning to love myself. There's a lovely little book by Walter Trobisch called Love Yourself that you might find if you're interested in this subject. Now, of course, the modern secular psychological view is that you first learn to love yourself and then you learn to love other people. And I'm suspicious of that way of putting it, because that suggests to me I'll spend my lifetime caring about myself and then I'll worry about loving other people. I do think the two go together, loving myself and loving other people and loving God, receiving love from God, receiving love from other people, receiving love from myself. These are all knit together in what is for me a mysterious way. But it seems to me that from a Christian point of view, we start out with God's love for us, and with that, we learn to love ourselves and other people. Finally, to creation. This is a subject that is easily distorted within the tradition, because so much of Platonism, that is the teachings of Plato and other philosophers from Greece, were adopted by early Christian teachers, and those were teachings which suggested that the spirit is good but the body is bad. And that also suggested that this whole world isn't of much value, that it's simply something to be discarded. The stereotypical view is, I am a soul trapped in a body, and the sooner I can drop this body and get back to being just a soul, the better. And often contrasted with that is the Hebrew view that my body and my soul are one person. And that's very attractive to us in the 90s. We like to recover that wholeness of the human being. And that's part of the reason I think that the term spirituality today is so popular. because the term intends to be holistic. It intends to cover your whole life, not just one aspect. Protestants previously had used the term devotion or piety to discuss similar subjects to spirituality. But neither of them seems to have the whole character of spirituality as it is used today. So we have become increasingly aware that we are ourselves creatures, we are ourselves physical, in a physical world which God said was good. We have a helicopter, sounds like. In fact, there are three main Christian doctrines that affirm the importance of the environment and the creation. And the first, of course, is the doctrine of creation itself. I speak now not just of the account of creation in Genesis 1, but of the teaching about the value of this world, that God intended it, that God loves it, that God intends us to be stewards of it. Secondly, the teaching of incarnation, that God became a human being in Jesus, who was body as well as all that the rest that goes into a human being. And finally is the teaching on the resurrection of the body, that somehow, in a mysterious way, our bodies will be raised and that we will not be ourselves unless we are embodied. We aren't just ghosts, according to this understanding. And if you find this a startling idea, please have a look at 1 Corinthians chapter 15, in the New Testament, where in 58 verses, Paul more thoroughly discusses the concept of resurrection than any other chapter in the Bible. So, we live in a context, and that context is an important part of our spirituality. I like to say that for any person, Christian or not, it's a sign of this, is that we need to get out of our boxes for part of each day. This is a wonderful box we're in here. I like it because of its mystery, its differentiation, and its intimacy, all of these at the same time. This is a wonderful box, but it is a box. And you and I live in boxes for the most part, in our homes, in our cars, our trains, our offices, our workplaces of various kinds. And we need to get out and tread on soil and look at sky and hear water. And whenever we do those things, we are refreshed. So, for me, Christian spirituality involves relationships. I also would say that it involves experience, or experiences. We meet God, we meet one another, we meet ourselves, we meet the creation, and something happens. There's an event. Now, Lutherans are very scared about experiences. They like doctrines much better. Doctrines are a lot safer than experiences. And they're afraid that people will base their salvation on experiences, because Lutherans, following Paul, will say, we are justified by grace. That is, by God's gift, not by any achievement of our own, any experience of our own. And they're particularly shy about being born again experiences as basis for one's salvation. But my question would be, isn't this just like the post-Luther Lutherans who said, you ought not to do good works, because if you do good works, you're likely to start trusting them for your salvation. So don't love your neighbor, don't work for justice. don't do anything good because you're likely to start trusting that for your salvation. I say, isn't the same thing true about experiences? If we have no experiences in our Christian walk, it becomes a very dry intellectual matter of being a Christian. And finally, I would say that spirituality has to do with habits. And another word for them is disciplines. What do you do when you get up in the morning? What do you do when you go to bed at night? How do you eat? How do you live your daily life? I remember a conference on spirituality that I attended in Berkeley, California, where there was a Jewish speaker who told us the Jewish prayers for getting up in the morning. She taught us to say, and I have forgotten the prayers in detail now, but when you open your eyes in the morning, you say, praise to you, King of the universe, because you have created light, and I can see it. And then you put your feet on the floor beside your bed, and you say, blessed are you, ruler of the universe, because you have made the earth, and I can stand on it. And likewise with water and everything else that you do in the morning when you get up. It's a way of being conscious, of being mindful, a way of being grateful. I like that little phrase, an attitude of gratitude that people develop through these kinds of habits. Now, two fundamental of such habits for Christians are prayer and meditation. And they include both communal prayer and private prayer. We don't do much communal meditation. We could learn from the Quakers, I think, to wait on the Spirit. We Lutherans tend to be very left-brained, very scholarly, very rational type people. At least the theologians among us do. And the right side of the brain, the creative, the experiential, the intuitive, needs more development. And perhaps one of those ways would be to have more silence in our worship services. I don't know. Meditation is like listening prayer. Meditation is like being with God without having to chatter all the time. If you have a good friend, you may feel perfectly at ease with that friend without talking. Whereas with a stranger, you feel, now what are we going to talk about next? How can I keep this conversation going? There's a well-known story about a French priest who went into his little church and found a man from his congregation sitting there. But he wasn't on his knees, he wasn't saying his rosary, he was just sitting there. Well, he let it go. Next day he came back. There he was again, and the third day, and the fourth. Finally he stopped and he said, just what are you doing? Oh, the farmer said, I look at him and he looks at me and we're just glad to be together. So meditation can be like that, or prayer can be like that. Now, there are other rather specific kinds of discipline that we can recommend for people to help along the way. And many of us are adopting them these days. One of them is to go on retreats. Now, I'm not talking about the retreat your church announces when it says the church council will go on a retreat. No, no. That's a long business meeting is what it is. or a workshop on X, Y, or Z this weekend up on the beach or in the mountains or something. That's not a retreat. A retreat is a time to set aside to meet God and one another, to be quiet, to listen. More or less guided according to how you structure it. Another discipline is having a spiritual mentor or advisor or director. That is one person who will listen to you carefully, ask good questions, and keep confidential what you say. Now, this is not a therapist, and it isn't traditional pastoral counseling either. This is someone, clergy or not clergy, who most of the time has some training in knowing what to do about as a spiritual advisor, who will listen to you and ask you and nudge you along in your spiritual walk. How is your prayer life going? What are the problems that you're facing right now? Where do you hear of the grace of God in your life? These are the kinds of questions that such a person will typically ask, among many others, of course. Now, I do want to mention while I'm thinking about it, and I am thinking about it as I'm talking, that there are spiritual disciplines that we don't name as such. They are the ordinary experiences of life. Moving is one. We're doing that right now, so we're thinking about that. Moving from one apartment or house to another involves looking at all your possessions and evaluating them. It comes with us, it's stored, it's given away, it's sold, Aunt Susan wants that, whatever. You evaluate your possessions, and it's often a painful experience to see how many possessions you have. I like to say, out of our house a few weeks ago in Minneapolis, that an ordinary grocery store has about 50,000 different items in it. And our house must have had 50,000. And maybe we've gotten to 7,000 we've decided about, and we've got the other 43 to go. But it just seemed like we'd do a lot, and then things would just ooze out of the wall. And there they would be all over again, and the room would not be empty, but full again. So moving is a kind of spiritual discipline. Parenting is another kind of spiritual discipline. I've thought of it in a new way. Since my children have gotten older, I have come to realize that once you're a parent, you're always a parent. That wasn't evident to me from the start. I thought, after 18, you know, they're off. Once you're a parent, you're always a parent, and a first part of the discipline is giving your consistent attention to these little ones who want and need it so much. You sacrifice often a lot of things to give them your presence and your attention and your energy and your money. You sacrifice other things for them. But the second stage is letting them go. And that happens in increments, of course, over time. But I'm experiencing that now very deeply as our youngest son has just set off for college 2 days ago from Holden. And so we didn't get to send him off from home, as it were, but we've sent him off to college now. That's an important step in letting go, but there are many others. And this is a kind of spiritual discipline. Well, there are many different spiritual disciplines, and I have mentioned, I think, 16 of them in this little book that I wrote, two after each of the 8 chapters. And it's for each of us to decide how to carry out those. Because, as someone said earlier, spirituality is a very individual matter. I always thought when I was growing up that everybody had to do it the same way. And I'm learning now we don't. Some of you were here last week when I had a session on prayer and meditation. And I mentioned this book here called Prayer and Temperament. This is a book which takes the Myers-Briggs types and suggests that people of different personality types will find different kinds of prayer more fruitful for them than other types. And of course, the Myers-Briggs types are only wide generalizations. And so each of us is invited, I think, to experiment, to explore, not just to do it the same old way all the time, but to find ways of praying that fit with who we are. And that applies not only to prayer, but to other kinds of spiritual disciplines as well. Well, now I've been talking way too long, and I hope that what I've said has stimulated something in you that you would like to either comment or question, to correct me or add on to something, or tell an experience of yours that has somehow to do with spirituality. So my view about spirituality is that it's relationships, experiences, and habits, and that for Christians, those are centered in a triune God in a good creation. So please, now, what have you to say? Yes.
Is worship part of the discipline that you discuss?
Yes.
Because I find that to be really helpful in more spiritual. The sermon may not do it, or sometimes it does. Choir or prayers.
My spiritual director said to me, "Go and join a choir, because you need that music. You're too used to thinking things through in your way. You need more artistic expression." So when I go to church on Sunday, I really have come to look forward to the other parts than the sermon. And if the sermon is good, that's frosting on the cake. And I've chosen a church that has the Eucharist every Sunday. And that becomes for me, the music and the Eucharist and the prayers become to me the most important part of the service. And the sermon, well, fine or not. Any other talk about the worship as a discipline before we leave that? Yes?
I want to me, it all kind of starts coming in together. That's the holistic thing. And so when one talks of worship, one ends up living out worship. And it seems to me that worship emanates from and goes back to the Word. My deepest discipline and my deepest worship at the same time is to read and then reflect. And that reflection can take all kinds of forms. Sometimes I'm a little bit of a Francis of Assisi and I dance. Sometimes I draw, sometimes I write in a journal. A lot of times it's just lay on the floor and just let happen what's going to happen. But by reading the gospel or a lesson or something that is touching me that is related to what's going on in my life at a particular point in time, that becomes a jumping off point for me in a daily life. And in that jumping off, then that whole process is a worship that then compels me to go forth from that point. It's a renewing moment so that I can, after that moment is over, go on with life, but re-enter life and yet be renewed and born into it. And so it becomes worship, prayer, and life all together once one has experienced this time with God. So to me, it is very vital to have that kind of connection on a daily basis, whatever form it takes. So I have not picked up a journal, to write in a journal now for about a year and a half, and just now it's starting to come back to me, it's time again. So there are times, and it's good to know that that's okay.
Thanks for that. And also for the suggestion about journaling. Journaling can be a very helpful spiritual discipline. Other thoughts? Yes?
In our modern day, it seems like a lot of things interfere with the habit of worship. That is, in our house, Sunday church or worship on Sunday is an expectation. If you're in our house, we go to church. It's just a habit, it's a discipline. And yet, today, many people go to the lake, or they go on vacation, or they're from Minnesota, they move to Arizona for the winter, or from Arizona, they move to Minnesota, no, they move someplace else. And on Sunday morning, then, worship sometimes becomes less of a priority, and it is no longer a habit.
And so, what shall we do about that? What shall we say about it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We find attendance down, and regular attendance down. The habit that family is there every Sunday is that family comes when they can. And attendance goes down, and income in the parish goes down.
I appreciate you saying that, because I personally think community is extremely important for nurturing a sense of spirituality and connecting with God and relationships. But I went through a period of time, and maybe I'm a typical, you know, case, but after I graduated from college, I went through a long period of time, 5 or 6 years, looking for a church, or not even looking for a church, feeling that a church wasn't where I was going to get spirituality needs met. I felt, felt the need to start my own Bible study or prayer group in order to meet that need. And I felt for many years that prayer group and study group that met on a Saturday morning, you know, for an hour and a half or 2 hours, met those needs much better. I had to go Saturday morning, but it wasn't that important to go Sunday. And which has changed now, I need both. But there were periods, my own personal experience, where small community was much more important, and it still is today. That small group needed has been much more important than a larger worship. And I'm not sure whether it's where I was going to church or a period of time, but I think something, I also felt the need of an emptiness. I felt an emptiness in Sunday worship. And I'm wondering if a Lutheran church, if we're in a crisis or something, because I went to many Lutheran churches on a search and found the same problem with churches dwindling. I'm from California. We have a major problem in California, I think, as far as the Lutheran church, and meeting, adapting to the needs and the changing population and things. But I don't know how that connects with the spirituality and what levels.
Well, Lutherans are discussing very much how their worship service should be done now. And there's a lot of confusion.
Yeah, major.
So you'll get a lot of different ways of going at that. It seems to me that many churches are not very friendly to the concern for spirituality, that you will not find much teaching in the churches about the spiritual disciplines, that you may not find those small nurturing groups that you're talking about in some churches. And so it leaves some people with the feeling that churches are simply empty of spirituality. And that reinforces these secular spiritualities in their views that religion or Christianity and spirituality are just two entirely different things, instead of what I would like to do is bring them together.
I I think sometimes we left the church, or what the primary reason, in fact, I think they were afraid of people who were beginning to express the feeling of spirituality because it was threatening and they were uncomfortable with it. And we were getting away from the norm. They didn't like that. They didn't want to change. Mm-hmm.
Church has not wanted change. My wife tells me that she has learned that whenever anyone wants to change something, the immediate response is always negative. You should expect it. That's what she's telling me. If you have a renewal movement or a new idea or something in a community, the first reaction will always be, no, we're getting along fine, don't bother us, let's always do it the way we've always done it. But if you persist, and if you get enough people within the community convinced that this is a good idea, eventually that negative opposition will disappear and you will be able to do the change or the renewal that you want. But at first, there's always that first stage, she tells me, when people will oppose a change. And I suppose that part of that may be that those of us who've been to seminary a few decades ago find new ideas, new ways of doing things a bit threatening because we didn't study spirituality in seminary. It wasn't part of our training if we went in the 60s or 50s or 70s or whenever. It wasn't part of our training, and it's a bit like me as a college professor trying to relearn things in light of the women's movement. Everything was he when I was in school. And to gain a new understanding with women's understandings involved, that has been a shift and a new development for me. So it is a challenge for professional people to keep up with what's going on.
I guess it's always difficult to get out of your comfort zone.
Out of your comfort zone, yes.
I was going to say that this has nothing to do with the worship aspect of it, but what came to my mind was, I guess, the word awareness. And I think that the more you study the word, the more you are surrounded by, you know, people within your own faith community, I think the more you become aware of how the Spirit in small experiences is in your life. So I think it has a lot to do with awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you. And back here.
I'd like to go back to your God and ourselves. In learning from my own experience, difficulty in learning to love myself first without it being, well, if I love myself, that means I'm egotistical and I think so much of myself. And I don't really remember where the change came, but once I learned that unless I love myself, I couldn't love others in the way that at least God intended. And I think by learning to love myself, it gave me a confidence to accept new ideas without being threatened, so that I could see the other person's view, and it didn't bother me because I had confidence in myself and I was able to accept it. So I think it's very important that especially men realize that loving yourself is not an egotistical move, but it's a move that gives you a greater confidence to accept others and yourself.
Thank you. Yes.
Well, those lines, yeah, the awareness part is valuable. I appreciate the way you organize it, you're thinking here. It's spirituality in terms of relationships and experiences and habits, and to think of my own life that this fits for me, I can see that. But when I was younger, no, it didn't fit. And I see teenagers, or I see, you know, children, and, you know, is there a spiritual essence in them too, and yet they don't have relationships, experiences, and habits in the way that you've just outline for us? And is that spirituality too? How would you describe that?
Well, it seems to me that, you know, the Catholics, they love to talk about spirituality of this, that, and the other thing. They're the ones who started speaking about spiritualities related to their religious orders. So there's Benedictine spirituality, Jesuit spirituality, Franciscan spirituality, and so on and so on. Then they started saying, well, wait a minute, we're not all monks. Afterwards, you know. Oh, yes, there are this 98% of the church that are the faithful. What about them? Then they said, let's have a spirituality for women, a spirituality for men, a spirituality for professional workers, a spirituality for homemakers, and a spirituality for children. And it seems to me that the people who are studying religious development or faith development would be close to talking about a spirituality for children, which would be different from that for middle-aged people like me. And I find that when I'm teaching at Augsburg, this is part of my limitation, the students who are 35 and more are able to relate better to my teaching about spirituality than students who are 18. And part of it, I think, is because you have to suffer a bit before spirituality starts meaning a lot to you. That is, there's a kind of self-confidence in teenagers that doesn't see the need for a lot of these things that those of us who are wounded a bit have experienced, have seen. So I find people who are just, who have had some life under their belt, they're ready for this way of talking about spirituality. But I haven't yet come across the way to speak to 18-year-olds about it. And maybe some of you have, and maybe some of you are in that business, I don't know. But I think your point about the age group is very important. Yes?
Father Chet Michaels has used a lot of the Myers-Briggs material and has done the connections between different personalities and different spiritualities, different approaches. I think has a very valuable tool there. And I would recommend it highly for anybody who has not taken the Myers-Briggs test. It's not a test, really. It's more of an aptitude, what my preferences are kind of thing. But what comes out of that is that each of the Gospels, there are four basic temperaments in the way that Kiersey thinks, and Kiersey, I think it is. Thinks, and Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John fit those four temperaments.
Yeah.
So that is a real attractive and easy kind of a way to get a lot of good clues quickly. That book right there is gold, that one book. Because by reading through and getting a sense not only of who I am and what I tend to be like, it also helps us think in terms of other people we know around us, people in our congregations, in our communities. And so it helps us see how we all link together so beautifully. The other thing that happens if one goes to the Gospels in this kind of a thought process is to say, now I'm strongest in this particular area, and this particular Gospel therefore has a good beginning point for me, a good place where I'll resonate. But there's that shadow side, that opposite side, those other ways that we could be. And in the fleshing out, as we read the Gospels and those other ways of could-be-ness end up making us richer people to explore them and to explore the thinking. And that particular book really helps tag people into that.
So with that encouragement, if any of you would like to borrow my book, you can do that. If you're here for a couple of days and you have time to do some reading, just come up and ask me afterwards and I'll loan it to you. Yes, Joe.
I've had the frustrating experience of teaching a high school class in Sunday school. We don't call it Sunday school, we call it Youth Sunday Morning. And we don't have a lesson, but we have a half hour hanging out, a half hour, what's it called? Sunday Morning with Dr. Joe, and then a half hour hanging out. Now, so they can play pool, they can play basketball, then we get together for a half hour, and I want some teaching. I want them to know the books of the Bible, but they don't know Matthew from Hezekiah. Or the book of Noah. I want them to be able to talk about the Bible. I want them to talk about relationships. But it's very difficult to think that we have really done anything worthwhile during the talking. But what is happening is that there are relationships. And one will come if a friend comes. And three will come if two friends come. And six will come if five friends are there in one class. And I've also found that age doesn't matter. I don't need to be a young person that knows what their thinking is. Because we relate real well, and I respect them and listen to them, and we find that there are some things they're interested in, and it's sometimes very personal, and sometimes it's a lot of doubts, and they learn that they can have doubts, and they can say something controversial, but at the end of the year, I wonder, what have we accomplished? Because I want to accomplish something, but I think it's going well. I think it's okay, but it isn't the way I wish it could be. I wish we could have an hour of teaching, learning, but that won't work that way.
They don't sit in chairs and they don't sit.
No, and you know, if someone's sitting there with a baseball cap over his face and he looks like he's sleeping, I think and hope that he's listening.
But he's being cool about listening.
Yeah. It's not cool to be eager about Sunday school.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But so we look for different things. We'll go in the gym and I'll sit on top of a ladder and drop something and do something completely different. Or we'll bring snow inside and make a snowman, snow
person
inside. Or we'll do something crazy. I'm learning a lot of tricks, magic. Okay, that's pretty fun, pretty cool. But, one day I took a bunch of Bible verses that are really kind of shady stories, really kind of juicy, sexy, and I said, X-rated stories, no one under 18 allowed. Of course, everyone is under 18. And a couple of kids took it seriously, and they didn't come. But we talked about the Song of Solomon and about some of the stories and the old in the Hebrew scripture talked about things that were really X-rated stories. But I'm hoping that in a year's time we can get some things that will make them like church better, that will give them a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, prepare them for college. But it takes, I don't know if I'm succeeding or failing.
We tried another approach. We decided to dump confirmation.
Ooh. Wow.
And it worked wonderfully. What we ended up doing was taking a look at the confirmation materials on one side, and then on the other side, looking at development in the teen years. What are the issues that are hot for the kids? We came up with things like authority issues and communication and self-identity and peer groups and, you know, wanting to be popular, all these kinds of things. And we put the material back together with that And so, for instance, we call it faith leadership development seminars. We don't have confirmation once a week. We have it once a month, with the exception of Christmas and Easter, for the benefit of the pastor, because they are so intense. And they go from Friday night, about 4 o'clock, until Saturday about 1. Kids are allowed to miss one session through the year. The idea being there's 2 years of it, A and B cycle. The first year starts with the Ten Commandments. The second one starts with the Apostles' Creed, first article. And in both cases, it is reiterated that if we love the Lord our God with body, heart, soul, and mind, that means there are no other gods before us, including basketball, dances, da-da-da-da-da. And the kids go, ooh, hubba-hubba, but they do it, and they love it. What we do is, for instance, the Lord's Prayer is a form of communicating with God. So we get into communication theory that relates to how do we communicate to other people, and then we tie that in with communication with God in prayer, and enter the Lord's Prayer that way. Lots of Bible study. And the concept is that if these kids have dealt with these core issues in their lives, they are going to be natural leaders in their school because their heads are together. And what has happened is our kids have been evangelists, our confirmation classes have doubled and tripled, and the ultimate joy for this pastor was, after confirmation, I actually have had on several occasions kids come back and say, can I take it over? So that's we're doing something right. I can't write it to copyright it, because I borrowed from so many places I probably would be accused of plagiarism in several instances, so I can't do that. But it's working. So
that's great. Right,
exactly. Oh, and we always end with contemplative prayer.
Uh-huh.
Kids look forward to it.
Some of these Taizé chants and Taizé type worship, such as we had here Saturday night, are very effective with young people. Well, you've heard the bell go. It's time for us to quit. So thank you for this morning.